Right now, imagine that it's 9:15 at night and your radio has just come to life. Ladies and gentlemen, Gene Shepherd.
Thank you. All right, come on, let's hear it. You realize this is at least 6 hours before I'm even up. Down on Washington Square. Is there anybody out there? Yeah, there's some people. Did you know I used to teach here? I taught at NYU. I'm thinking of writing a confession. Yeah. Oh, yeah, it really did, you know, over here on 4th Street. And the course of the name of the course was the Revolution in American Communication. Dynamic. I love education. Jesus, you know, you can sit there for weeks in a classroom, a faint breeze blowing through from the air conditioning unit. You can smell the chock full of nuts down the street. And some son of a bitch is talking about the Punic Wars. You ever have those moments when you sit in the back and say, what the hell is it all about? And you have to calm yourself. I know what it's about. It's about 5 credit hours. Yeah. Education. And I suspect, by the way, that most of us get our real education when we're sitting quietly at night. Our soul is in the middle distance. Our eyes are focused on limbo. The TV set is going in the corner. Your jaw is hanging slackly. You got a bag of Frito-Lays. A 6-pack of Diet Strawberry Yoo-Hoo. You mean you never saw Strawberry Diet You? It's one of the biggest. What? It's a true obscenity of our time. I mean, that's actual pornography. It comes in 6 cans. Jesus. Doesn't taste like You. It doesn't taste like strawberry. And you're sitting there. And on comes the Preparation H man. No, seriously, I wonder how many of us, though, today, actually, the separation between the education that we're getting here at NYU or giving or being involved with and our actual life, it's growing wider and wider. You're looking at a guy that actually got through organic chemistry. And nothing has been organic since. I don't know what it's about. So I wonder about this. Yeah. I remember some of the great moments of education, though, that I had in school. True education. I mean, education that changed your entire life. 3 o'clock in the morning, I wake up some mornings. Look at the ceiling. And I remember my dormitory, Indiana University. You know, Indiana, do you know, any of you ever heard of Indiana University? Yeah, Saturday afternoon when Ohio State beats them, right, I know. Indiana University is completely, the entire university is made of poured concrete. I mean, it's just like they had a giant mold. You know, University number 3, I set it down. Poured the concrete in. The jolly green giant created Indiana. And there it sits on a hillside surrounded by plastic trees. By the way, that is a problem, you know, at Indiana. Due to the climate out there, ivy will not grow. It's a fact. So they got it from Sears Roebuck. Comes in big rolls, you know, they headed up and down the side of it. So help me God, Ed. It was one of the first experimental ivy-covered plastic universities. We were very proud of it. You know, for one thing, you don't have to water plastic ivy. And another thing, though, that makes plastic ivy really great is that starlings love it. 2 o'clock in the morning, 17 million starlings would be in the plastic ivy outside of my bedroom window. And by the way, starlings, like human beings, know no bounds to their sin. You know, your starling isn't your average bluebird. Oh, no, the reason people hate starlings is that they're so much like people. First of all, a starling walks with his knees. You ever seen him? Just like people, you know, regular birds walk around like this, but there's starling ones. I have seen starlings with cigars sticking out of their beaks. You always get a feeling that a starling, you know, is looking at chicks, you know. Telling dirty jokes to the other starlings. And they do not act like other birds. You know, other birds have a specific mating season. The starling has discovered mating as a major sport. And so, late at night, I'd be in my tiny dormitory room in Indiana. It was about 6 feet this way, about 8 feet deep, poured concrete, ceiling, floor, walls. Had a little window like this. I'd stand here. Incidentally, there was a chest of drawers over here made of poured concrete. A little concrete knob. That's Indiana. Over here, I had a little concrete desk. There was a concrete bed here. You're used to those, of course. And the walls would, late at night, you'd hear them sweating. You know, concrete sweats and groans quietly. And I was at that moment of desperation. That moment that always presages one of two things. Either education is about to occur, or pregnancy. Now, it's obvious that I would have trouble with the second one. You never know that, though. Late at night, it's 2 o'clock in the morning. It's Friday night.
And of course, you guys go to a city school here. I mean, you're right here in the middle of it all. You've got the rich, teeming, fecund life, the steamy compost heap of the village all around you. By the way, I live here in a village over on 10th Street. Classical village pad. Upstairs, there are two girls. They keep running around, yelling at each other, and I can hear the whack and the thump of bullwhips. Typical village life, and below me there are two guys who wear tinfoil shoes. They're continually playing Judy Garland records. Could hear it floating up the air shaft, you know. Bullwhip going down, Judy Garland going up. And there in the middle of it all, a shepherd trying to kill cockroaches. Is this what life is about? How the hell do I know? I'm just here, just passing through. 2 o'clock in the morning. I've had that first insight that nothing actually totally makes sense. Have you ever had the sneaking suspicion, which incidentally you constantly try to get rid of out of your head, that it's only you that's truly screwing up your life? All the others have got a plan. Oh, Christ, you go to every classroom I've ever been in, at least two-thirds of the people look very official. They're all sitting around here, you know, taking notes. They look like they really like organic chemistry.
Me and about seven other guys are always sitting in the back there sweating. You ever had the feeling that at least two-thirds of the class has already taken it? They really belong here, you know?
Their hands are going up before the guy even asks anything, you know?
It's like a, yes, sir.
You're sitting back there, oh, Christ, don't call on me, Jesus. Friends, it never changes. All of life goes on that way. How many times have you gone to a party and felt that everybody else actually belonged there? And you just were being tolerated. Yes, that's known as dynamic creative alienation. Or anachronistic alienation. You could work in that like play if you want to. I've known of people who've made an entire career of their alienation. This is known as the Philip Roth syndrome. You could parlay it to a movie contract if you work at it. And there I am, in that poured concrete room, about to discover one of the basic facts of life, that there is nothing that drives people more into doing what they do than boredom. Rich, deep, satisfying boredom. Oh, yeah, you know, sometimes boredom gets so thick that you can actually reach out, roll it around the room, play catch with it. And it was boredom that was getting me. There I was, a junior, pacing my concrete room. It was Friday night. And by the way, Friday night is always the night of the great itch. Oh, God. I mean, if we didn't have a weekend, man would have to create one. Imagine what life would be like with no Saturdays. It was always eternally a Monday. And Friday night, we had this thing. So you guys live in a city school where, you know, you can just walk out. And, you know, there's great places to go to. You know, you got the chock full of nuts right down here. You know. But Indiana is separated. We're out in the country. And Friday night, if you didn't have any dough, man, you were in trouble. You were trapped in his cell. All the other people, the official kids, they were always gone. In their Dodge convertibles, off into the sunset, yelling and cheering, wearing their letters. And there's Shepard. Remember, it was a Friday night that I had my first true insight into what life was about. It's 2 o'clock in the morning. I was wearing my jockey shorts. That's all I had on. And by the way, speaking of poetic moments, may I take a moment here to salute one of the great little moments of ecstasy that only males know. After all, that's what a poet does. Takes that little tiny moment of joy and makes it into something large. There's no feeling that I can describe that is close to the feeling that a male has when he opens up the bureau drawer on that day. He figures, to hell with it all, I'm going to let it all, I'm just going to do it all today. And he opens up a brand new package of jockey shorts. It takes that new jockey short out there, dung, dung, you know. That card, you know, it comes wrapped on the cardboard, you know, you take the cardboard out. And then you put that pair of jockey shorts on. Oh, God. What a feeling. You're walking around. Oh. It's just a very special feeling. For the one moment, everything, you know, it's all together for one moment. You know, just... And then about 3 weeks later, you're walking down the street. The rubber is all gone on it. Starts slipping down over your ass, you know. How many times you fall down around your knees, you're walking along. You wonder whether women know these things. These are little male traumas. There I am, my jockey shorts. Rain has come down. And next door, in the next room, in this giant concrete prison we were in, was Goldberg.
Goldberg had been in almost all of my classes, two of us. We'd become sort of twin victims. Yes, I remember Goldberg. I remember Goldberg particularly in American History, too. He used to just sit there all through the class and mutter. He was next door. Saturday morning was coming up. We were trapped. The whole weekend we were going to be here. I remember out in the darkness it was raining. It always rained on the campus. It's 2 a.m. And out in the distance, way out towards west of Bloomington, Indiana, town that makes Secaucus look like Palm Beach. Oh, yes, I'll never forget some of the more romantic nights in West Bloomington. Yes, I remember one night in the Golden Eagle Route 41 diner. I was eating a slice of cardboard pumpkin pie. It's all part of the American dream. And out there in the darkness, I can see a flickering red light out over the hills, over there by West Bloomington. I never noticed it before. It's a red neon sign. You can see it glowing in the falling rain. It's going up and down. It's a big neon arrow. It just keeps pointing. It says, eat, 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 eat. What the hell's it about? It's a typical American expletive sign. You don't see signs like that in France, India, Bulgaria, Finland. Only in America do you see signs that say, eat, or beer. Beer. Kind of like that one, you know. Driving along the turnpike at 2 a.m, a big sign says, beer, eat. Do you ever have moments when you think of signs that you would like to see? Big red arrow, do it here, bam. Well, there I am in my concrete room, sweating. And I see over here on my little concrete desk, my log table. Had this little leatherette book, Logarithms. Next to it was my slide rule. You know that I carried a slide rule in an alligator skin case, weighed 18 pounds, on my belt for over 5 years, and I never knew how the son of a bitch worked. Other guys would take it out. Numbers would fly out of theirs. I'd just take mine out and slide it back and forth. Then when nobody was not looking, see, I divide 17, divide by... I never trusted it. Oh, and I'll remember that log table. Laying next to that log desitrig rule. And suddenly it hit me. What the heck? What am I doing? My life is going this way. I'm messing around with logarithms. The square root of -1. How many of you thrill at the sight of the square root of -1? Little bracket. Little 3 on the top. Line underneath it, 2x over 2d, umlaut. God, that stuff is really exciting. Now, up to this point, I had been excited by that stuff, but all of a sudden it was empty. Rain is coming down, and I see this girl walking right across the campus, right through our beautiful, historic Indiana
university, colorful, bridal walk square. They call it the bridal walk. Nobody ever got married there. Just seemed like a nice name. West Point had one. I see her walking down there. She's got her hair up in... It looks like she's wearing aluminum rheostats. Little lightning was playing around, you know? Rain is coming down. She was a typical Indiana University co-ed. About 5'2", about 207, I'd say. This little cute round bowling ball with feet trudging across the campus late at night. And she was wearing these toreador pants. Remember when they had these toreador pants? Here I was up on the third floor and I could hear them thrumming all the way up there. They were that tight. They were the Montgomery Ward special that year. The Picasso model. Inspired by Picasso's late blue period drawings. Yeah, and there was this big three-eyed lady on her behind. Eyes kept going up and down. I'm looking at that. It suddenly hit me. What the hell is it all about? And then there was a moment of sheer ecstasy. Under my concrete chest of drawers, I had stashed last Wednesday a 1-pound box of magnificent A&P and Page Fig Newtons. How many among you here tonight are Fig Newton fans? Let's hear it for the Fig Newton. You notice there's just a few clapping, the others are saying, what the hell is that? Fig Newton cuckoos are rare, dedicated people. I mean, when you're living in a world of Yankee Doodles and Ring Dings, Twinkies, a Fig Newton is a rare and beautiful creature. It's packed so nice and round. And those figs are solidly packed in there. And row on row, the little Fig Newtons march. Such beautiful symmetry. You've seen them packed chock-a-block in there. Each little Fig Newton waiting to do his best to give his life for you. And it hit me, God, yeah, I've got a box of Fig Newtons. And so I dive under the concrete chest of drawers, bring the box of Fig Newtons out, and I sit down on it. Oh, God, at least there's something. I looked at it, unopened, beautiful. Little did I realize I was about to embark on one of my great educational moments. First of all, the Fig Newton box had that little dotted line. It says open on dotted line. You know, it has a little thing for your thumbnail. See that? It goes up like that. Have you ever tried to open? You ever have images, though, of real people? All those packages open for them? You know? Triscuits, it says, press back the top, press the thumb here, raise it up, close it immediately following to preserve the freshness. And you start throwing it, you know? Stick your thumb, nothing happens. Stick it in front of the face. Son of a bitch! Tear off the top. Triscuits all over the room. Goddamned animal. Well, anyway, I just went zip with the thumb, torn a package off. There they were. You know, they come in packages of two. The two halves open up. I sat back, opened it up. I mean, you know, let's face it, it ain't a six-pack of Pabst, but they're mine. It's 2 o'clock in the morning. It's Friday. There's nothing else to do but eat Fig Newtons in the institution of higher learning. I could see in the darkness the famous Greek library, all the plays of Aeschylus, Sophocles. Rain's coming down. Out in the darkness, that arrow kept saying, eat. What's it about? What is education? I took the first Fig Newton out. He's just about to take that first nip. He had some kind of antenna. I hear these shower clocks, clump, clump, clump. And it's big, fat Goldberg. Says, you got Fig Newtons. He could smell them through the concrete. That's the kind of dormitory we had. Goldberg, you know, there's Goldberg, 380 pounds. He's about 4'6". You ought to see him wearing his jockey shorts. Oh, wow, you know. Looked like a Band-Aid that had sprung a spring somewhere. It was hanging down, you know. Goldberg says, hey, you got Fig Newtons, I can smell them. And he always carried a calabash pipe with him. And he smoked this unbelievable tobacco. His room was always right about eye level, right to the top. It was filled with this purple smoke. He smoked this special tobacco. You know, it was Saturday night in a Turkish whorehouse. It was very heady smoke. And he comes in, he has his pipe, and he went, so, I see you're having Fig Newtons. I says, yes, Goldberg. So, I just ran out of Fig Newtons next door, and I says, okay, Goldberg, come in and have a Fig Newton. After all, the milk of human kindness, we were both squatting in the rowboat of life, floating on the vast sea of ennui, headed for God knows where. So I says, yes, I can have a Fig Newton. Gee, these are Ann Page. I said, yes, they are, Goldberg. See, the really classical Fig Newton is the A&P, Fig Newton. I had a second-rate Fig Newtons around, but this is the real Bippy, you know. And he said, gee, these are good. I said, have another one. Just don't mind if I do. We're both sitting there having our second Fig Newton when suddenly down the hall we hear the sound of approaching shower clogs. Everybody wore shower clogs in our dormitory. Anytime after 6 o'clock at night, they hear clunk, 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 and there standing in the door, big number 72, Al D'Aguelio. Over 7 years, a Big Ten running guard. Al D'Aguelio was made entirely of gristle. Had no muscles at all. He was just solid gristle. You hit him and it go thunk, 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 thunk. And by the way, he was a true classical Big Ten athlete. They are born and not made. In fact, I believe some of them are of a different species. First of all, he didn't breathe like you and I breathe. He had blowholes. Big, heavy, gristly nose. You could hear him. You could hear the faint burbling sound when he was intake of air. I'll be damned. I think he even had webbed feet. And I come in there, Big Al. See, and he absolutely never paid any attention to any of us. He was the pride of our dormitory. You know, here was an All-American. By the way, he later went out to play with Green Bay in the NFL. Big Al D'Aguelio never paid a damn bit of attention to any of us. It was very flattering to have him stand in the doorway of my dormitory room and say, hey, you got Fig Newtons, give me one. He could smell them downstairs. So I says, yes, big number 72. Here, by the way, he actually had a jersey that he had earned. You know how many guys buy these jerseys down at Herman's, you know, 72, 12, 19. They're little 4'9" guys, big thick glasses. Al was born wearing a jersey. Actually, he hit the ground with a set of shoulder pads. And so the three of us sat there for a couple of minutes eating Fig Newtons. Huge. Al's sitting there wearing his jockey shorts, rippling muscles. He had a neck that started right here. You know, it went down at a 45-degree angle, just went zap. His mouth always hung open, ever so slightly. You could see three teeth where they'd been removed by a helmet.
in the university, you know, the Michigan game. Big Al, number 72. About 10 minutes went by when silently they appeared in the doorway, somebody who would really make it big here at NYU. Tall, thin, elegant, stands in the doorway, was Bob Umbaugh, Robert W. Umbaugh, the president of everything. He was the leading light on the literary magazine. He edited the Poetry Quarterly, president of the junior class, straight A plus student. Stood in the doorway and he says, did I hear that you're enjoying Fig Newtons up here? I said, yes, Umbaugh. Funny you ask. By an odd coincidence, me and number 72 and Goldberg are enjoying Fig Newtons. Would you care to join us? Little did I realize, I was getting in the clutches of a hustler. Hustlers are everywhere. Umbaugh walked in. He says, I see there. Ann Page. It's a rather decent Fig Newton. A bit pretentious, but not without charm. So for Christ's sake, Umbaugh, have a Fig Newton. Stop talking about it. He takes the Fig Newton. To say, I wonder if any of you gentlemen know the etymology of the fig. It's this kind of singing evening that makes education what it is. He says, are you aware that the fig, rather interesting fruit, you know, that the fig is pollinated by a small moth, which grows only in the area where figs proliferate. Number 72. Look. You mean there's a moth there? He says, yes. Every fig is pollinated, gentlemen, by a moth. The moth takes the pollen from the female fig, flies over, mixes up with the other fig, and the next thing you know, the leaves close over the moth, which means that in every fig, there are the tiny remains of a moth who gave his life so that you could enjoy a fig. I mean, there's dead moths in this, huh? He says, well, yes, actually, but it adds to the flavor of the Fig Newton. You didn't know that about the Fig Newton, did you? It's true. So we sat there and ate our Fig Newtons. We finally finished the box. And Umbaugh entertains us with various discussions on how the bran of the wheat is removed to make the special coating of the Fig Newton. Without any warning, he produces a small blue box. Umbaugh takes the box, opens it up, and out of the box, he takes a tiny silver-wrapped tablet, puts the box down, opens it up. At that point, Goldberg says, what are you eating? Umbaugh says, X-Lax. Would you care for one? Well, Goldberg never turned down nothing to eat in his life. Remember, it's boredom we're talking about here, gang. It was hanging over this room like a thick miasma, a swamp. And that's the whole point of this story. You're going to hear a sordid tale of education and why boredom is why we are what we are. Umbaugh says, would you care to have one, Goldberg? Goldberg says, yeah.
He takes one of the X-laxes, opens it up. Yeah. Umbaugh says, you'll notice that it tastes like a fine Swiss chocolate. Big Al Tegelius. So, Umbaugh, of course, Mr. 72, there you go. Says, and you? I says, yeah, I'm part of the gang, what the hell? And so the four of us each had one X-lax apiece. It was the beginning of a fantastic evening. Umbaugh walks over to the door casually, as his type is wont to do. He says, say, gentlemen, a little proposition to make for you. I'll bet you $5 that I can eat more X-lax than anybody in the room. Well, first of all, DeGallio, in his entire life, had never turned down any kind of a challenge.
Guess why? Okay, I can eat all of that. That's just like chocolate.
Goldberg says, hey, I like that stuff. I'll give me it, you know? I had a little inkling of what was about to occur, but I was going to go along with it. I was as bored as the next, so I said, sure, all right. I don't have $5, either does Goldberg, but we'll have it next week. He says, okay, $5 a piece, right? To be paid whenever you get it. Goldberg says, yeah. DeGallio says,
yeah, you're stupid, of course.
And I said, naturally. He says, all right, we will begin. How about let's beginning with you, Goldberg? And he passes the box around. Each one of us downs our second X-lax. At that point, I said to him, I said, Umbaugh, how do you judge? He says, the last man in the room wins. I mean, let's face it, that's a basic rule. And so, passed them around again the third time. That's three X-lax. Elapsed time was about 40 minutes. We're talking. Passed it around again. Four. I'll never forget that moment. Up to this point, I've been so innocent. It'd be like eating these little, you know, pieces of Nestle chocolate. When all of a sudden, it was Goldberg who went first. Goldberg stood up. Instantly, we parted like the Red Sea. He charged for the door. One of his shower clogs flew off. I heard him running down the hall. You can hear him go, doom, 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 doom. And all of a sudden, it stopped. I heard this high. He didn't make it. By this time, there's about 40 guys are all around the door. You know, they're watching. The word has gotten out. The great X-Lax Derby has broken out, you know. Guys are cheering, you know, and there was a whole crowd standing around Goldberg, you know. And I want to tell you, it's catching. I think it's the sweat on his nose. It was that white staring eye. It was that look of terror. It got me. I ran out. Oh, my God. And I ran past Goldberg's fantastic. Goldberg weighed about 360. And when I went past him, I'll tell you, he didn't weigh over 140. It was unbelievable. There was this little skinny guy laying there. Oh, holy God. About 20 minutes later, I come staggering out of the john. And I go work my way back to the room. I could see Goldberg. He's slowly crawling along the corridor there, making faint moaning sounds. And there's a big crowd outside my room, see? And I can hear him cheering when I come up there. And I walk in, and there is, in a fantastic face down, is Umbaugh and Al DeGallio. They are now on their 11th tablet. I never saw any courage like this. I mean, it was fantastic, and Umbaugh is playing it really cool, you know? He's got such style, such grace.
I mean, you know, you can always tell pros in any sport. They make the hard plays look easy. I mean, you see these guys playing in the world. Pete Rose, you know, it doesn't look like work hitting with him. That's the way it was with Umpa. Cool. He said, well, that's 11. Mr. DiGallio? Now, give me another. Ain't nobody gonna beat me at nothing. Oh, God. Friends, if you think you're good at anything, just remember one thing. In all that vast sea of humanity out there, there are at least 500 who can cut you going away without even sweating. Just after the 14th X-Lax, the crowd was roaring. Some were cheering for DiGallio. After all, he was a Big Ten guard. Others were cheering for Umba. His fellow intellectuals were cheering for him. Just after the 14th one, Big Al stood up. His shoulders went down like he was about to hit the Michigan line. He charged forward and didn't even get out of the room. It was my room. Unbelievable scene. I'm standing up next to the wall. There's DiGallio spread out. Umbaugh fastidiously backed away. Umbaugh just looked down at that quivering figure of DiGallio. The crowd roared. Seven or eight people dragged him out. He was hanging limp. 15 minutes later, after Umbaugh and half a dozen other guys had helped me hose down the room, Umbaugh then pulled, this is style, style. That's what life is about. Umbaugh says, I think I'll finish the last one. No sense in just leaving one left. Tosses it off, looks around the room and says, who'd like to go down with me to the International House of Pancakes for breakfast? And out he went with his entourage. And from that day on, a legend was born, friends. When you'd see Umbaugh walk across the campus, he looked like some kind of a desiccated stork. He'd walk across the campus, big, thick glasses. People would point him out. There goes Umbaugh, the X-Lax King. Truly a talented man. There were rumors that he didn't even have the same plumbing as the rest of us. I'm inclined to believe that. Well, it was at that point that I realized, after that historic confrontation that night, and that early dawn, it hit me. What is it about? This is higher education. I really have learned something here tonight. There are the talented, but then there's the rest. No substitute for talent. Years went by. I kept thinking of Umbaugh. One day I'm watching Sunday afternoon television. You know that official kind of TV? Comes on channel 13. They always have this Moog music. And now, the problems of Western civilization, a panel discussion. Have a whole bunch of professors sitting there. And the, you know the show. The deeply concerned MC says, good afternoon, viewers of public television, deeply concerned people. Today, our panel has gathered in our Washington studios to discuss the fate of Western man and its relationship to basic American humor. The professors from left to right who will discuss this problem, and I can't believe it, over on the far left is Professor
R.W. Umbaugh, professor of history, the University of Chicago. And he came on just as serious as Steve Allen, delivering a lecture about how we should learn to love one another. You know, those great lectures you keep seeing on 13. And I kept thinking, my God, I wonder if this guy's pupils know his real talent. I kept wanting to say, go, Umbaugh! Challenge the whole crowd to an X-Lax Derby on TV! The best show the Channel 13 ever had. Certainly the most honest. They deal in the same product, only they package it better. Let's hear it, gang. All the rest are serious subscribers who send for the program listings. So you'll not be able to forget this time that Etruscan Art and You is on Tuesday afternoon. Yeah, I always tune Channel 13 on once in a while because I know it's good for my soul. Yeah, I you know, like some guys jog, I turn it on occasionally. There's always a lady with a pointer in front of a blackboard. She's always saying, and in the late Etruscan period, you'll notice that the... Then they come on and ask me for money to continue it. Then I see somebody's constantly doing push-ups. She's wearing a leotard. She calls it yoga. Oh, God, where will it ever end? And so it is on moments like that that I and nights walking along 4th Street through Sheridan Square, I just wonder what all of this study that we're involved in, what is it about? Where is it leading us? You know, they had schools in ancient Phoenicia. What the hell did they study? No better, no worse. I mean, I studied the Punic Wars for 2 semesters. I haven't even met a Pune. I'm not anti-intellectual. I just wonder what it's about. Nobody's ever asked me even about them. I've waited, you know. Just once, I'd like to have, say, Barry Farber come up to me. Say, Shepherd, tell me about the Second Punic War. God, I'm glad you asked, Barry. I got a B+ on that son of a bitch, let me tell you. No, it's all stored up here. Quadratic equations up here. dx is to dy up here. The halogens up here. Yeah. The carbon compounds up here. All the while I walk down 4th Street and the rain comes down. And I watch guys steal hubcaps. Oh, yes. I wonder. Late at night, I turn my television set on. To see all the great heroes. I think this is where our education is really coming from. How many of you have watched that lady that comes on, usually late in the afternoon? The one that looks out, she's wearing her hair, it looks like a little football helmet. Yeah, they got a lot of strange people doing commercials, you know. She's got a big beak, she's got funny looking hair. And she's in somebody else's john. And she's looking down, full face shot, and she says, oh, oh, blue water. Have you seen that lady? I wish I was an innocent person. If I hadn't seen the X-Lax Derby, if I hadn't been part of that, if I hadn't been in Company K of the 3162nd, I would never think the way I do. The minute I hear her say, blue water, the same thought goes through my head. Somebody in that family's in trouble. We had lectures in the Army about that. I could see half of you saying, what's he talking about? The other half says, if you have to ask, you'll never know. Blue water. And then what does she do?
You absolutely, without question, unconsciously compare your life to the things you see. You always do. What does she do? She turns around and takes the bank off the churn. How would you like a friend like that?
Comes over and says, can I use the John? Goes in and takes the bank off. You know? See what you got stashed in the back there, you know? She takes the bank off the John, and there, in the John, is this poor little 3-inch-high son of a bitch, and he's rowing a boat. A 3-inch-high man in the John, and he waves. That's a nice touch. He's wearing a yachting cap yet. Good God almighty. And what does she do? Does she do what you would do? What you unconsciously suspect you know you would do? No, she doesn't do that. She looks right at him and says, blue water. She discusses the water with a 3-inch-high man in the John. He says, yeah, yeah, he waves. She says, very good, puts the top back on. Good God. That is, incidentally, the epitome of the liberal attitude. Never discuss a person's infirmities. Never even notice that he's 3 inches high. That he lives in your John. Live and let live. He does his thing, I do mine. Now I ask you, what would you do if you went home tonight, turned the light on, and there's this little bastard rolling around? What would you do? Would you flush him down? I could see you running into the street screaming, ah! There's a 3-inch-high guy in my John! Says, oh, get out of here, for Christ's sake, you're kidding. Yeah, there he is. You watch. You see those people on TV? You notice the guy that comes and sits down? There's a group of people there, and the mother, the father, the kid, and this guy comes down, sits down at the table, and he says, well, and somebody says, happy birthday, Dad. And he says, yeah, fine. He says, say, doesn't your old dad get fresh squeezed orange juice? And his wife says, no, you like number one. It's more like fresh squeezed orange juice. And number two is even more like fresh squeezed orange juice. So you're getting number two today. He says, old dad, he gets some more. Apparently everybody else is getting fresh squeezed orange juice, but not old dad. Why not? He's a daddy. Daddies have nobody to give sustenance to. In fact, one of my saddest of all daddy commercials is the one where daddy is in the John. You ever seen that one where daddy's looking into the mirror? He says, oh God, I haven't made a sale in 7 weeks. I've just got to make a sale today. And he's shaving. And suddenly you see his daughter, apparently. She's this 12-year-old, fantastic-looking little, you know, she's tremendous-looking little chick. She looks in, and she says, Daddy. He says, yeah, yeah. She says, have you tried Micrin?
So what's that?
Daddy's 42, has never heard of mouthwash. See, according to the mythology of all television commercials, anybody under the age of 14 knows everything. It's only people of 42 who don't know a damn thing. So Daddy says, what's that? Huh? She says, it's Micrin, Daddy. It has foaming action.
So what does it do?
She says, it kills germs 4 ways, Daddy. Try it.
So Daddy tries it.
And 5 minutes later, we see Daddy running up the steps of the house. His new Cadillac Eldorado's out in the back. He says, thanks to little Mildred and the Micrin. And you sit there. Maybe that's what my life needs. Micrin. And you try it. It just tastes like vaguely diluted peppermint water. Nothing changes in your life. How many of you have tried Right Guard and it does not work? You're wetter than you were before. Do you suspect that you personally are inadequate? That the others get the real Right Guard? Have you noticed those guys that look so happy every time they have a TV dinner? Yeah, you know, it's called Hardy Man. He's eating this little plastic chicken. He looks so happy, you know, and his wife is saying, he says, you sure are a good cook, Mildred. That's TV land. Have you noticed there is not a car sold on television today that gets less than 37 miles to the gallon? Says right on the bottom, whatever the hell that EPA is. Says 37 miles to the gallon. You look at that son of a bitch and you know, 1,800 pounds of iron just in the hood alone. And you know this car, maybe it gets 34 miles to the gallon downhill with the key off. You know, with seven guys pushing it. And then those tires, if you notice those great tires go roaring through the snow and through the rain, big claws. You look at yours, lump on the side. Everybody's life is a wee bit tacky compared to what you see in television. 5 minutes after you buy the new AMF Pacer, somebody has written a four-letter word on the door. And an Airedale is stopped by the left rear tire. You wonder about it. Have you ever, now here, you go, how many of you go to NYU here? Well, have you ever wondered what it's like in a real college? I mean, oh, I'm not putting down the intellectual achievements of NYU.
No.
But would you like to go to one of those real schools where they have girls jumping up and down, you know, with the horns blowing? They've got guys named number 32. Yeah, just once in a while, you think. Life is that way. New York is bankrupt. Well, what are you applauding for, you idiot? Listen, there were three bastards that stood on the bow of the Titanic when it went down clapping. Oh, there are people who love disaster. Here they clap. He's applauding us going down for the last time. I've thought, you know, there's many ways that New York can save itself. We ought to have a giant lawn sale. You know, Mayor Lindsay's desk. He's been for sale for years, friend. He's just waiting for the big TV roll to come on. But seriously, here we are, you know, we're sitting in the middle of a city that's about to go down the drain. You know, and I just wondered about that. Many times I've thought about that because, you know, this is, we're all in it. And I wonder what some future historian, Gibbon, of, say, the year 2180, he writes the rise and fall of the Empire City, New York. We're on our way down now. In fact, they said that at the time that Rome was falling, the first indications of it was that you'd find a lot of beer cans in the streets. Cigar butts. People walking around, you know, wearing burlap togas. Oh, yeah, as Rome got hipper, it sank deeper. Until one day, all it was a place where people went and took pictures standing in front of the Colosseum. Maybe we ought to, you know, take a lesson from that. We ought to start selling dirty pictures here. Have people come from Cleveland to have their picture taken in front of Gracie Mansion. Who knows? We're slowly sinking. But don't worry about it. I think we'll come back. Maybe 5,000, 6,000 years from now. Yeah,
it takes a long time. The big swoops of history, you know, move like giant rivers of maple syrup. Slow, inexorable. And here we are floating on it. Just drifting on history.
We're 20th century men.
I mean, you know, like 18th century men, 17th century men. Let's see, the 17th century was the age of reason. And it was the 18th century, early 19th century, that was the Romantic age. What age are we living in? You thought about that? Can you imagine a guy sitting around at the time of Louis XIV and he says to his friend, he says, has it occurred to you that we're living in the age of reason? Pierre, and you're certainly not holding up your end. How about living in the middle of the Romantic age and you're mad as hell? Now, here we are. I don't know what this age would be called. I think it could be called the age of the total ego. It could be the ego age. Could be the age of Madison Avenue. Could be the age of great illusions. Could also be the age of Johnny Carson. Yeah, have you ever watched late at night? You turn your TV set around and there's Johnny Carson. It's always on. He's always sitting next to Zsa Zsa Gabor. And there's Ed McMahon selling Alpo. Gives you a sense of continuity. But there are things you can count on in our life. You switch over and there's Merv Griffin. He's always talking to Toadie Fields. Mike Douglas is always talking to Rocky Graziano. And on it goes. And Walter Cronkite, every night at 7, comes out. He's got that little button in his ear. Looks very solemn. And he says, and in Beirut today, the Muslims and the Christians battled it out in the street. And you watch and you say to yourself, I wish just once I could feel concerned about Beirut. Cronkite is so concerned. What's the matter with me? All I want to know is what the hell happened to the Giants again this year. And he's got that button on the ear. Has all the answers. You begin to suspect that that button is attached directly to God. And there you are, walking through life with no button. And then at the end, half hour, boy, talk about ego. At the end, he says, that's the way the world was. Just wrapped up the whole world in a half hour. Took Toynbee 48 volumes. Not Cronkite. 30 minutes, including 8 minutes out for commercials. And 4 minutes for sports and features. That's the way the world was tonight. Bum, 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 bum.
No wonder we're confused. Then on comes Walt Disney. After that comes All in the Family. Archie Bunker. That crowd. Then Mary Tyler Moore. I never saw a television station in my life like that one. It seems to center all around this girl who works in the newsroom. Fascinating station. They don't have ratings. Nobody gets fired. Nobody sits, drinks heavily. That's TV world. And then late at night, on comes old movies. I love old movies. Turn on a set at 2 a.m, 3 a.m, 5 a.m in New York, and the old set's just sitting there with the ears. It's always full of life. Turn it on, there's the Preparation H man. Looking right out at you and says, Preparation H is medically proved and guaranteed to relieve itching. Say that to a man at 4 a.m. and he has to wonder, what itch?
You notice the Preparation H man lives in an office that's surrounded by leather-covered books. The book is a fetish in America today. And he takes a book out every time he does his commercial. and it says on the back, medical proof. That's a great book to have. I love that. It's a typical TV book. He says, medical proof. Preparation H is medically proved and guaranteed to relieve itching. And he opens it up. It's a typical TV book. It has 8-inch high letters, you know. It says, Preparation H, medically proved to relieve itching.
You look at it.
And then he takes the book, puts it back.
I don't know what kind of mind you got, but late at night, I keep, in my mind, I keep seeing them medically proving it.
The way I see it, there's a whole bunch of people standing in various little cubicles with white smocks with numbers 8, 19, 37. And there's a doctor walking around saying, uh-oh, number 6 is scratching again, you know. There goes number 3. Yep, yep. And here's a guy with an H on the front. He's just standing around. You know? Medical proof.
So, you know, it's just like, you know, driving along the turnpike of life. 3 a.m, you're hurtling along the Pennsylvania Turnpike in your Pontiac GTO. That Reynolds wrap hood is dingling along near the front. All the green lights are going on, 8-track stereo. And there's a voice deep down inside of you that said, you should have gone in Harrisburg. This car's got $12,000 worth of accessories. And there are some necessities it does not have. And then, as you drive faster and faster through the darkness, hurtling on, trying to think of anything else but what's really bugging you. You ever tried that technique? I'll think of something else. A tree. You think of the tree, then you see a dog walking up to it. The way the human mind works. And then out of the darkness at 3 o'clock in the morning after you've driven 38 miles at 225 miles an hour. Green signs coming out of the darkness. Food. Restrooms ahead. And there it comes out of that blackness. The orange glow in the dark. Howard Johnson. Charlie made it again. How can you explain Howard Johnson to Mo Si Tung? That's American. At 3 a.m, when you line up with your fellow Americans, you know that there is a oneness in that great inverted bowl of night. And that great river flowing off to one side of Manhattan. Yes, that river moving along. Lined deep down with people wearing concrete overcoats. If you stand on the George Washington Bridge and you look down at that river, stuff floats by. If you watch long enough, you'll know why they call this Fun City. Darkness, education, NYU. Robert W. Umbaugh. X-lax, differential equations, log-log desitrig slide rules. Yes, and over it all, that great Preparation H man, giving you medical proof that life exists rich and deep here in New York City. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Come on, let's hear it. Thank you.